This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. On Christmas Eve, 1963, a young woman named Lucille Rinaldi was murdered in her apartment in downtown Chapel Hill. Her husband, Frank Rinaldi, was arrested and charged with the murder. Over the next 2 years, the trial consumed the attention of that town. Nora Gaskin was 12 years old when Lucille Rinaldi was killed. The case left an indelible impression on her. And now, almost 50 years after the murder, she has written a novel loosely based on the event. Her book is called Until Proven. She'll be reading at 3:30 today at Bull's Head Books in Chapel Hill. And Nora Gaskin is with us now on the program. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Let's go back to the original murder, the one that really took place in Chapel Hill in 1963. Tell us about it.
It shook the town. Chapel Hill was no more than a third the size it is now. And the university was a third to half the size it is now. Even the public schools were more centrally located. Chapel Hill High School and Chapel Hill Elementary School were where University Square is now. So the town was much more compact, smaller, and had that small town feel. So a murder like Lucille Rinaldi's was just impossible. It could not happen there. My father was involved because he knew Frank Rinaldi. Frank was a graduate student in the English department. My father was a professor in the English department and supervised instructors teaching freshman English, one of whom was Frank. So my father knew Frank, believed from the very beginning that Frank was innocent, and so he, my dad, and other people supported Frank throughout the ordeal. That meant that my family's life, to some extent, centered on and circled around Frank Rinaldi's ordeal, too, for those 2 years.
So, and murder like this certainly is one in which everybody has an opinion. What was the widely held opinion, or was it evenly divided among the folks?
It was very much divided. There were many kids, even in my junior high school, who, because of the talk that they heard at their homes, they believed that Frank was guilty. There were people on the streets who believed that Frank was guilty. People who knew Frank tended to believe he was not guilty. They just did not see it in the man, and they knew that he was very excited about becoming a father. Lucille was pregnant when she was killed. So it was divided. Probably, if you could draw lines, you would say people who did not know him and wanted an answer, wanted a solution to this awful crime, wanted it to be him. People who did know him believed it could not possibly be him. And the facts would tend to support the people who thought he was innocent.
Now, interestingly enough, Frank is white, his wife is white. She was pregnant, as you said. But race did play a part in this because of the one witness that linked him to this crime.
That's right. There was one witness. I call him Eddie in the ebook about the true crime. Eddie came forward after Lucille was found dead and told people that Frank had offered him money to kill her. He also said that Frank had made sexual advances towards him. Eddie was black. I had a friend, again at my junior high school, a girl who'd been my close friend since first grade. She told me I was racist because I did not believe Eddie. So even that, the element of race split people down the line as to how it affected the believability of this man.
And that, you say, was a common feeling, that if you didn't take Eddie's word for it and believe that Frank was guilty, then somehow you are racist. You
Chapel
weren't
Hill,
a black man.
Yes, Chapel Hill was going through its own civil rights crisis that year. If people have read John Ely's book, The Free Men, all about the civil rights movement in Chapel Hill, then they will recognize times and places. And Lucille's murder is even mentioned in passing in that book. So Chapel Hill was very much divided along racial lines. Chapel Hill had prided itself on being a liberal town. That was the reputation, much as it is today, I think. And suddenly liberalism there was being challenged. We also found out who the opponents of integration were, the downtown businesses that refused to integrate, some of the businesses on the outskirts of town that refused to integrate. So suddenly race was in the forefront. If you were liberal, your status as a liberal was being challenged. by the uncovering of the lack of liberality in Chapel Hill. So it turned into a kind of a reverse thing, that if you were liberal, you believed Eddie.
Well, and it also goes to show how race plays such an important part in our criminal justice system in so many subtle and varied ways, and it can work in both directions. But the fact of race playing a part in our criminal justice system then and now is irrefutable. You wrote two books about this. You wrote an e-book that is roughly the true story of what happened
Correct.
In 63. And then your novel, The Mystery, Until Proven.
Yes.
Why did you decide to do that? What was the impetus behind the novel itself, The Mystery?
I began writing the novel before I had the idea of trying to write something that put the facts of the true case on paper. I am a fiction writer, so I filter stories through that lens. And I had felt for many, many years that I would eventually write a book, a novel, about the situation generated by the Frank Rinaldi case. So I began with the novel. It is, in many ways, different from the true case. The differences between the reality and the fiction, I think, are very clear. The similarities would be that, as you mentioned, I was 12 when Lucille Rinaldi died. And then I saw a man who in my house was always innocent, not only charged but convicted, and spend a year in Central Prison for a murder that I believed he did not commit. That, to a 12, 13, 14-year-old girl, especially whose father was involved, always supporting his innocence, that was disturbing. How could this happen, especially in my idealized hometown? So that was a continuing question in my mind, and one that I knew I would explore in fiction one day.
Frank was convicted and then later was given a new trial and acquitted.
That's correct.
So all of this is going on. Through it all, your father was a supporter. What was the – and let's go back to the real crime now. What evidence – what was the case that the prosecution built? Because there was a decided lack of material evidence linking him to the crime.
There was no material evidence linking him to the crime. The prosecution put together a case of innuendo. They took Eddie's statements that Frank had offered him money and had made sexual advances, and they ran with those two facts. They put together – well, excuse me, those are not facts. They ran with those two implications. They painted a picture of Frank as being an outsider, someone who is not from here, and he wasn't. He was from Connecticut. He was in Chapel Hill for just a few years in a graduate degree program. He dropped in to Chapel Hill. No doubt he would be dropping back out again. So they could paint him as an outsider, a person who was just not like the rest of us. And they used the allegations of homosexuality to bolster that. They showed that he didn't have much money and that Lucille had a $20,000 life insurance policy. So he was a man in need of money. Kill your wife. Easy. And they played fast and loose also with the scientific evidence in the case. The medical examiner testified that Lucille died between noon and 12 o'clock.
Wait a minute. Noon and 12 midnight?
Excuse me. Between 10 a.m.
Okay.
and noon. I'm
okay.
Sorry. Thank you. The prosecution just gave the jury permission to disregard that scientific evidence, and they took that permission and found him guilty in the first trial.
And the reason that's significant is that Frank could prove where he was at that time.
Correct. Yeah. There were 8 to 10 people who could and did testify that Frank was elsewhere during that 2-hour time period.
So now back to Until Proven, which is your a fictionalized version roughly of this story. You have two murders take place.
Correct.
Tell us about that. First, the Vance family, the murder within that family, and the fact that this one matches a little more closely the actual Rinaldi murder. Is that right?
It does match more closely. It is a case where Sheila Vance, married to a man named Lawrence Vance, is found murdered in her home. She's pregnant. And Lawrence Vance, her husband, is charged with that crime. And differences would be The Vances are very much insiders in the town in which they live. They are old money. They have some power, and yet still he's charged with the murder.
The second murder takes place 4 decades later.
Correct.
And there we see a different family with a very different background.
Yes. There is, still some of the members of the Vance family are still around, 40 years older, and a new generation has been born. But a young woman, again, a young pregnant woman, is found dead in her apartment. In that case, the man who is the father of her child, not her husband, but the father of her child, is charged with the murder. But it goes off in a very different direction from there.
Can I have you read for us?
Sure.
This is from the novel Until Proven.
Just a little bit of a setup. Colin Phillips is an attorney. He is married to Retta Vance Phillips. Retta's brother is Lawrence Vance, and Lawrence is married to Sheila. As this scene begins, Retta and Lawrence have gone Christmas shopping together, and Colin is at home in his study.
And takes place in December of 1963. Is that right?
Yes,
is that, the
that is
okay.
correct. Mm-hmm. The telephone call came in at 3:30 in the afternoon. Retta, near hysteric, insisted that he come to Lawrence and Sheila's house right away, but wouldn't say why beyond something horrible has happened. He'd never been to Lawrence and Sheila's house, but he knew the streets around the university well enough to find it, and there were three police cars in front of it. He pulled up beside one and identified himself to the young officer who stood beside it. "Yes, sir, we knew you were coming," the officer said. Lawrence sat in a porch chair, his face in his hands, shoulders shaking. Retta knelt beside him, her arms across his knees, and was talking, talking, talking. Colin knew how it was when she spoke that way, close and intense and uninterruptible. When he leaned over them, Retta said to her brother, "Do you understand? Do you?" Then she turned to Colin. Her face was colorless, her lips taut. Sheila's been murdered.
Nora Gaskin reading from her new novel, Until Proven. She's going to be reading at 3:30 today at Bull's Head Books in Chapel Hill, but with us talking about this novel and her e-book, a second book about the Rinaldi killing in a killing in 1963. Did you go back and do much research for the novel itself? And did you find yourself, 'cause the e-book clearly has a lot of evidence, and we'll hear later some testimony. With all of that actual evidence of the crime and the reminder of that event that happened when you were 12 circling through your head, did you have a hard time sort of writing a novel and not just rewriting the story itself?
Interestingly enough, I did not have trouble writing a novel, though I did go back to the material that I had on the actual murder from time to time, I think mostly to re-enter the intensity of all of that and to re-enter the feelings of division that were swirling around that in the town and in my own experience in life. So I'd go back to it for a little more inspiration, not directly, but for the sense of place and time and intensity that was going on.
And in the novels, Until Proven, there are two murders, as we say, 40 years apart, two families, the privileged white Vance family and the working-class black Minton family. They are related. They're connected. And I won't have you give all that away, but there are connections. Did you do that in the novel in a way to reflect some of those tensions that you talked about that were present in 1963 as a way of sort of fictionalizing but also exposing some of those tensions?
Yes, I did. I very much wanted to do that.
How does that play out in the novel? Can you give us an idea without giving away the book?
I'll see what I can do. The Minton family is a large extended black family living in an area of town called Sweetside. People who live in Chapel Hill might think of Northside when they read about Sweetside. Marie Minton had worked for the Vance family for a couple of generations, and she pretty much raised Retta and Lawrence to the expense of her own child. She had one daughter who did not turn out well, perhaps, at least Marie feels, perhaps because Marie's motherly attentions ended up going to these white children instead of to her own daughter. In the end, Marie winds up raising her grandson, Jabel Clark, her daughter's only child, her only daughter's only child. She raises Jabel, who takes his own turn working for the Vance family. So they are connected in social ways, but very much with that hierarchy always in mind.
You're a fiction writer, and this is obviously fiction. It's a novel, and it is a mystery. It is that kind of a novel. Is that writing is that what comes easiest to you? Is it what you like to do best, writing a mystery?
I read a lot of mysteries. I always have. For many years, I wasn't sure I could ever structure one. I wasn't sure if I would be able to write one. And then eventually my hope and desire that I could write a mystery one day came together with this story that had been simmering in the back of my mind for so long, and here we have it.
It is complex. It's a hard thing to do, that kind of structure. It's hard to get the structure of a novel right and then to keep the mystery in tension. It seems to me an almost extra layer in some ways.
I think it is an extra layer, and one that the book came pretty easily to me except for the structure. And I hope that in the end I finally got that right as well.
Reads pretty well, and you've gotten a lot of great reviews. And then Time of Death is the e-book.
Correct. Right?
Tell us about that and why you decided to do that as an e-book. That's the factual account.
It isn't long enough. It is not a book-length manuscript. It is a third the length, maybe even a quarter of the length of Until Proven. So because of the availability of the technology, I thought, well, perhaps this is short enough that even people who don't routinely read e-books will be able to read this on a device or a laptop computer and not feel that they're being too put upon to do so. And it would not be practical from an economic point of view to do a printed book.
Are they meant to be read together?
I would love for people to read them together. I've had people read one first and then the other, say A first and B second, B first and A second. And people have told me that whichever order they read it in, a couple of people have said whichever order they read it in, they wish they'd done it the other way. But they definitely tell me that one reading informs the other, and they're enjoying reading the two together.
And yet you could read the novel, for instance, and not know the backstory.
Absolutely.
It does tend to. So Absolutely. What happened to Frank Rinaldi?
Frank, after he was acquitted in the second trial, left Chapel Hill. A good friend of his tells me he was reclusive for some years, and that doesn't seem surprising to me. He did finish his PhD at the University of Massachusetts and had a career as an academic, as a teacher, and an administrator at a small college in New Jersey. He went back to his hometown and lived there the rest of his life.
So he was acquitted in the second trial, and then no one has ever – so now it's still an unsolved mystery.
It's an unsolved mystery, and I doubt very much that there will ever be a solution to it. There are still people who believe that Frank was guilty.
Nora, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Nora Gaskin, author of Until Proven and the e-book Time of Death. She is going to be reading at 3:30 today, Bull's Head Books in Chapel Hill. Coming up after a break, let's imagine the Marx Brothers on a piano getting close to the sound of two classical musicians who want to have fun with music. And we're going to do that right after this break. Stay tuned.